Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. As usual, the batting order of enemies foreign starts with the Chinese Communist Party. We devote a lot of time in this program and in the companion programs that I'm privileged to be helping to lead with the Committee on the Present Danger China's webinar series, which I strongly commend to you all if you're interested in the danger posed to us by the Chinese Communist Party, especially in the form of unrestricted warfare against us. And to the extent that we can help synthesize a lot of information into relatively accessible webinars and programs like this, I think it's a really important public service at a moment when we're finding the prospect of the old-fashioned kind of war with China now decidedly looming. And we have a desperate need to know what Xi Jinping, the newly coronated communist Chinese emperor, has in mind for us, for others, notably Taiwan, and for the world. And few people understand better all of that and do a better job of synthesizing it and making it accessible to folks like us than our first guest. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is, I'm proud to say, a colleague of mine at our Center for Security Policy, where he directs the China Policy Program. He is also an author of a number of important books, including a brand new one entitled Understanding the China Threat, co-authored with Lianqiao Han, who, as is true of Brad, is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China. We're very proud of these gentlemen, their work, and delighted to be able to present it to you on this program with regularity. Bradley Thayer, welcome back, sir. It's always good to have you.
Thank you, Frank, for your warm introduction. It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Well, it's decidedly warm, but also decidedly earned. Let me ask you, Brad, to sort of take stock with me, if you would, about what has happened at the very beginning of a new Congress in which a Republican majority in the House, albeit a narrow one, has laid out a couple of examples of the kinds of investigations they're going to be doing when they convene formally in January. Specifically, James Comer, who is expected to become the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, announced in a press conference earlier this week that one of the things that he was going to be investigating was Joe Biden's associations with and, well, compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. Do you think this marks a perhaps sea change in one of the most problematic national security arrangements, I think, in our country's history, namely that the commander-in-chief of our country does have such compromise in his background with respect to the most dangerous enemy we've ever faced?
Frank, I think it certainly does. It is a momentous event because it is the first time since Bob Dole raised this issue in the 1990s when he was running for president against Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton had hosted a series of what were called coffees, meetings with Chinese, Taiwanese, other officials who had influence with the Chinese Communist Party. And Dole rightfully raised attention to that.
And took a lot of campaign contributions from the Chinese communists, as I recall.
Indeed he did, and helped Laurel, Hughes Laurel, and other entities provide technology to the People's Liberation Army.
So, and bring them into the World Trade Organization.
Indeed. So, if you will, that was, in the American context, the dawn of elite capture. And Bob Dole famously asked, where was the outrage? why were the American people not outraged at essentially the loss of their birthright? What are we witnessing now? Well, we're witnessing again, so many years after Dole made that observation, we're seeing the first tangible investigation of elite capture conducted by the United States Congress. And of course, elite capture had only grown from, if you will, the baby steps of elite capture under the Clinton administration to involve Wall Street, the media, universities, the totality of the American elite with very few exceptions.
Yeah. Now, Brad, when you use that term, we bandy it about a lot on this program, so I suspect most of our audience is familiar with it. But what does that mean in practical terms? Is that people who are literally taking money and therefore are effectively owned by the Chinese Communist Party? Or is it a more multifaceted phenomenon?
Well, it certainly could be, as you observed, Frank, but it is multifaceted. It's influence, if you will. It can take many forms. It can be the old-fashioned form of bribery, right, which in some respects is the second oldest profession when it comes to political influence, or it could be the hiring of relatives or indirect, far more indirect mechanisms of influence that usually is a pecuniary. It could be political, or it also could be ideological as well. So the motivation is multifaceted, as well as the form is going to be multivariate as well.
But a particularly egregious example of it, I think it's fair to say, is Hunter Biden. As you say, that kind of indirect and pecuniary arrangement whereby he was clearly paid handsomely to give them access to his father and to presumably ensure that the big guy, as they say, was also compromised, no?
Indeed, Hunter was in many, the Biden administration, or the Biden family was influenced by many governments, Ukrainian, Russian, and Chinese. And I'm sure there are some others we'll find out in the course of the investigation, but that's exactly it. Now, China, of course, is the threat that we face. It is the hegemonic threat. It is determined to destroy and supplant the United States. So any interaction with a Chinese entity for purposes of selling influence, political influence, of course, in this instance, is outrageous and should be a disqualification for office. As we in the Center for Security Policy have identified, of course, and in the Committee on Present Danger have identified in terms of steps we should expect of our political leaders. And it should strike Americans as essentially the first measure is that you're not accepting bribes, you're not subject to the influence of foreign powers.
Right.
That's a very low standard.
Including in the case of the Bidens, directly Chinese intelligence operatives were involved in these arrangements, financial and business dealings and the like. So you're right to point to this investigation as a vehicle for ensuring that we get this right. And I'm very concerned that if we don't, in fact, have such a rigorous investigation as seems to be now being promised, we're going to see this problem continue to metastasize. It's not just Joe Biden, of course, who exhibits it. The elite capture, as you say, is endemic now. Among his senior subordinates, as well as in so many other aspects of our society, business, academia, and so on. So, Brad, when you look at this challenge and getting calculated properly the magnitude of the elite capture phenomenon, do you have obvious... Well, we're going to have to take a break. Let me come back to that question. We'll be right back with more with Brad there right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. House Republicans recently announced their determination to investigate Joe Biden's personal and deep compromise by the Chinese Communist Party. Unfortunately, evidence abounds of this most serious penetration of America's leadership by a hostile foreign power in the history of our republic. The most recent example is the Biden administration's acceptance last week of the principle that the United States has to pay what amounts to reparations to developing nations for helping warm the planet. If this agreement stands, we can only guess at the extent of the wealth transfer in prospect and its squandering by corrupt recipients. What we do know is that the Chinese Communist Party will be a prime beneficiary of this arrangement on the absurd pretext that China is still a developing nation and a responsible environmental steward. Memo to the GOP: say no to Joe, Beijing, Biden. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Dr. Bradley Thayer, the co-author with Lian Chao Han of this terrific new book, Understanding the China Threat. He is a very valued colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our China policy program, as well as serving as a member of our committee on the present danger, China. Brad, before the break, I was just teasing up the challenge that we will see faced, hopefully, by those determined to get to the bottom of the elite capture phenomenon, most immediately, obviously, with respect to Joe Biden and his conduct. But I wanted to get a sense from you as to the feasibility, given how far down this rat hole we are, of really both fully calibrating and taking corrective action with respect to the elite capture phenomenon. Just to give you one example, the prospect that if Joe Biden resigns from the presidency, which I frankly predict, that his successor, Kamala Harris, who is also compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and a number of others who may be in the wings, similarly, just to stay with the political sector of our polity, this is a big problem, is it not?
Well, indeed it is. It is because it's a betrayal of the American people. It's a betrayal of their duty and their responsibilities to the country, their obligation in terms of what they, what is necessary, of course, of our political leaders, the ethic of responsibility and the ethic of duty, which Max Weber famously identified, that's one of the jobs of the politician, is to do your duty with a fidelity to the people you serve and to do the best that you're able in that regard. And so what we've had is a profound failing for a long time of the American political elite. But it's more pernicious, Frank, because what it is the effort by the Chinese Communist Party to prevent or to deter any response to their growth and to their control. And so by
their rise, as it's called.
Their rise. Mm-hmm. So what they have done is essentially by decapitating, if you will, the American elite, a national security elite, highest political officials, what they have done is ensured that there will be no response, adequate, effective response to their growth. So this is a profound threat, and it's one that we have not faced before in our country. And I think as Justice Brandeis observed, right, sunlight is the best disinfectant. So what do we need to do is start shining some sunlight on this problem. Will it be the only investigation? Is it the only step? No, but it's a very important first step in this regard.
I agree with you, especially in light of the fact, as you've been chronicling in essays at the Epoch Times and The Hill and elsewhere, we're witnessing in the wake of this 20th Party Congress that Xi Jinping is emboldened and more dangerous as a result. We saw, and we talked a little bit about this last week, I think, that being kind of the leitmotif of the meeting between Biden and Xi, in which it seemed as though, as has been the case rather regularly, the United States got the worst of it. Talk a little bit about Xi's agenda as you see it now, Brad, and how the compromise of senior government officials and others in our society may be factoring into his calculations as to whether he could engage in, well, even old-fashioned conventional kinds of warfare with impunity.
Well, my argument is Xi is off to the races. Having secured his domestic base with the 20th Party Congress in mid-October, he has ensured his domestic position. So now he's able to move very actively internationally to bring about the changes that he wants. He's effectively brought about the changes he wants in the Chinese Communist Party, and now he's going to do that internationally. And so what we saw at the meeting before the G20 at Bali, and then at APAC immediately after, in Bangkok, immediately after the Bali G20, was that aggressive Xi. The dressing down of Trudeau, of the Canadian prime minister, is important for one major reason. It's important because it shows that he is now not a tacit or a timid character. He's not a retiring individual or a wallflower. He's out there boldly confronting leaders like Trudeau and disciplining them when they need to be. And so what we are going to expect is more of that. He's now going to be able to really essentially provide his imprint on international politics. With elite capture, Frank, the second part of your question, right, that ties into, well, if you do have this rising force, this aggressive leader in Xi Jinping, who's determined to bring about changes in the status quo, we need leadership. We need the American, the Biden administration, of course, to resist him and to ensure our allies, our partners around the world, that if they stand with us, that America has the diplomatic might, economic might, military might, to resist his encroachments.
You've written about the kind of strategy that we need, Brad, and I'd like to come back to that in just a moment. But before we do, you're a serious student of history, and one of the things that struck me about that conversation between Xi and Biden in Bali, set aside the complete improbability that Joe Biden actually conducted a 3.5-hour conversation with anybody, let alone Xi Jinping, which gives rise to the question, what was going on at the time, which, as you know, I have come to the conclusion that he was basically getting his marching orders from Xi. But be that as it may, the meeting seems to me to have some of the same hallmarks as to the infamous meeting that leaders of the West, Neville Chamberlain in the United Kingdom and his French counterpart, had with Adolf Hitler and his sort of mini-me, Benito Mussolini, back in September of 1938 in Munich, in which the Western leaders were desperately trying to avoid conflict and were making clear that they were prepared to countenance whatever, basically, the authoritarians wanted in the near term, as long as it was short of war, and that they misconstrued the true intentions of those interlocutors. That certainly seems to be happening now. And it took a year for it to metastasize into a full-on global conflict, of course. But is that a possible sort of template for this authoritarian, Xi Jinping, seeing the behavior of Biden and his team in this meeting in Bali?
I think the comparison is apt in the following ways. First, the Daladier and Chamberlain were deceived, but there was also a strong element of self-deception that was significant. Chamberlain thought he was getting time at Munich. He was going to get time to rearm. He didn't realize he was dealing with a hyper-aggressive individual who wanted to bring about dramatic and forceful changes to the European order. And we need to recognize that that comparison is certainly one which is spot on. We're dealing with a hyper-aggressive individual who's determined to bring about changes in the status quo. Chamberlain and Daladier also thought they had time.
I beg your pardon. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're going to talk next with a man who has come to the fore in terms of the efforts to raise the alarm about communism, both in his native Cuba, what it has meant for the phenomenon in our own country, as well as elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere. His name is Dr. Orlando Gutierrez Boronat. He is a PhD who has taught at the university and high school level for 25 years and written a very important new book entitled Cuba, The Doctrine of the Lie. And we want to explore with him the nature of that lie and its implications for all of us, as well as for the people in Cuba and elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere. Dr. Gutierrez Boronat, welcome to Securing America. Thank you for this really important book. I understand you showcased it at the Mexico CPAC that's just concluded, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Tell us a little bit about the thesis of this book, if you would, and its most important findings.
First of all, it's an honor to be in your program. Thank you, sir, for inviting me. Cuba, the Doctrine of the Lie is, number one, about what totalitarianism is. It's not something that disappeared with the Soviet Union. Totalitarianism is a very real force in today's world, and it's gaining ground rapidly. And in defining what totalitarianism is, I emphasize the fact that totalitarians work across the ideological spectrum. For example, in Latin America, you have a very tight coordination between extreme Islamist forces, especially those coordinated by Iran, and pro-communist, pro-socialist forces, which are directed from Havana, but which are being funded by communist China. And I know to many, this might sound like a grand conspiracy that can exist. No, that's reality, what I'm describing. The dual role of these anti-democratic, anti-US forces is very much a reality in Latin America. And I seek to define what they stand for, what they mean. And they don't hate us for what we do. They hate us for who we are. And they will not cease in their efforts to bring down the concepts of natural law, of freedom, of constitutional government, separation of powers, which are the cornerstone of our civilization. The second thing the book does is show what really happened in Cuba. You know, there's this completely wrong presentation of what happened in Cuba as a reformist movement that U.S. policy radicalized and turned them into dictators. No, that's wrong. From the very moment they began their armed struggle, Fidel Castro and his followers, they wanted to establish a totalitarian dictatorship in Cuba. And the nearsightedness of our policy helped that happen. But their goal definitely was to create a communist regime in a very crucial geographic area so as to then spread communism to the United States and also to Latin America. And it's very evident in everything they wrote and everything they did.
This is fascinating and deeply troubling on the two counts. One is, I couldn't agree with you more, the totalitarians, and I would throw in the globalists as well as the, well, I call them Sharia supremacists and the Marxists, of course. They all seem to have in common one thing. It's not necessarily the end states that they prefer, but it is the idea that the United States is the impediment to the realization of their goals, and therefore it must be destroyed. And this idea that getting the communist seed corn planted in the hemisphere, in Cuba, was really part of a larger agenda than the Soviet Union to get at the United States and other nations in this hemisphere is such an important insight. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that it's largly misunderstood. And we find ourselves today, and I'm anxious to get your thoughts on the CPAC conference and what you take away from it. But this idea that if we lose Brazil now, the most recent of the major nations of the hemisphere to go communist, it will be more or less the case from the Arctic to the Antarctic that the hemisphere is in the hands of the most powerful nations, at least, are in the hands of the radical left, the Marxists, communists, whatever you want to call them, the people who, you know, are inspired by and in favor of the Castro-type regime in Cuba. No?
Well, there's three points I want to make. Number one, I describe totalitarianism as an ontological virus. It's a disease that spreads and feeds off ideas to twist them and to pervert them. And one of the symptoms, one of the conditions of this virus are Western elites, both business people and intellectuals, who are seduced by these doctrines of power. I think that what they offer these intellectuals, what they offer these some of these businessmen, is a way to control the masses, a way to control large segments of population through a centralized state. But the damage that causes goes way beyond that. Number two, there's something which I insisted in my presentation. For too long, Latin American leaders ignored what was happening in Cuba. They saw the regime in Cuba as a temporary foe and not as an existential threat. And oftentimes the weight of confronting that regime fell on the U.S., even though U.S. policy toward Cuba has not been consistent, but it has been more consistent than most Latin American countries. So a point I pressed on the Latin American leaders present here at the CPAC, the conservative leaders, is that they must see the regime in Cuba as an existential foe, which seeks to bring down their culture and civilization. And that is a reality that leaders across the board, both political leaders, labor leaders, cultural leaders, have to realize. They're trying to destroy their traditions, their values, which keep them together as nations. And the third thing, Frank, the situation is very bad because they're creating a united Soviet Latin American Republic throughout the hemisphere. They're in the process of creating that. The good thing is that they have to do so through political means, because their first attempt at armed struggle was stopped. And because they have to use political means, that means we can still put up a very significant fight. Last week I was in Chile. The week before that I was in Costa Rica. I can tell you by going through the region that there is a significant movement of resistance against this and a greater awareness of just what it is that we're confronting. And it's a movement that uses many different topics across many different fields to strive for one objective, which is the suppression of democracy as we have known it.
As you say, that is good news. The bad news is that in most of the countries in the hemisphere, the major ones at least, we have now had the political mechanism used to bring to power these communists. And as you know very well, as a serious student of these matters, the old adage, one man, one vote, one time, I fear can apply, that we will not see those resistance forces given another opportunity through the political process, at least, to reverse what's happened in Peru and Chile and Colombia, now Brazil, among other places.
Well, that's a great point, friend, because right here in Mexico, the current president of Mexico, López Obrador, who's a big sympathizer of all these regimes, he's trying to eliminate the National Electoral Institute, which has been a guarantor of free elections in Mexico for decades. Just a few days ago, millions of Mexicans marched against that. So they're putting up a fight, civil society. But as you say, once in power, these regimes, these movements try to destroy the electoral system.
Take it down. I wanted to leave time. We're speaking with Dr. Orlando Gutierrez-Barrenat about, among other things, his terrific new book, Cuba, The Doctrine of the Lie. And in practice, you've seen this very, very aggressively pursued by, among others, this so-called Forum of São Paulo, which is a kind of communist international in our time, in our hemisphere. I wanted to ask you about the group that you're working with, the Assembly of Cuban Resistance. Talk a little bit about what it is and how you see its role in this environment.
The Assembly is the parliament of the Cuban resistance. It consists of organizations, 35 organizations inside and outside Cuba, and it's very diverse: women's movements, veterans organizations, labor, political organizations, youth, which have come together in this parliament in a strategy aimed at supporting the internal citizen uprising against the communist regime in Cuba. As of July 11th, 2021 of last year, the Cuban people rose massively against that regime. The protests have continued. There's a mainstream media blockade of what's going on in Cuba now with the protests, the graffiti, the desire for change. Over 240,000 Cubans have arrived in the U.S. since January. No one's talking about that. And it's part of the collapse of this communist regime. If Cuba is liberated, the entire region would breathe. It would bring oxygen to the democratic forces. But that needs consistent support from the free world. And it's a shame, Frank, it's immoral that the main financing of this regime today is not coming from Russia and China, it's coming from Europe and Canada. People who are slapping sanctions on Putin's Russia are sending money to Putin's main ally in the Western Hemisphere.
I would love to have you come back and talk more about China and its role in all of this, but just a last question quickly is, I understand that the Biden administration is making inroads in trying to prop up the Castro-era regime. Is that the case today?
Well, the sanctions that President Trump imposed on the communist regime in Cuba, in addition to the existing embargo, have crippled the regime's ability to maintain consistent repression. President Biden has maintained many of these sanctions, but now we're seeing different steps which leads towards a softening towards the regime. Last week, a high-level State Department delegation went to Cuba, supposedly to negotiate immigration issues with the regime. And what the regime did was it turned around the next day and announced that puppet President Díaz-Canel was visiting Putin in Moscow. A humiliation in U.S. policy.
Yeah, a real humiliation. Yes. We have to leave it at that. Dr. Orlando Gutierrez-Barrenat, thank you. And Godspeed in this important mission. We'd love to have you back very soon. Be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and a special welcome to our next guest who joins us from the great state of Maine. His name is Robert Charles. He's a frequent guest here. We're always pleased to have him, especially at a moment like this, because he brings a background in, well, every branch of our government, the executive branch under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush in their White Houses, as well as in the State Department, where he served as an assistant secretary under George W. Bush. In addition, he has been a counsel on the Congress oversight committees in the 1990s and as a clerk in the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit. So he's got a wealth of experience that we're always pleased to draw upon. In addition, these days, he is a spokesman for a terrific organization of which I'm proud to be a member, the Association for Mature American Citizens, and you can find Robert Charles's writings there at amac.us. Bobby Charles, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
Frank, I always appreciate being on your show.
Well, it's our privilege. Let me start by asking you to draw on some of that experience with oversight when the Congress became Republican-controlled as a result of the Gingrich Revolution in 1994. You served for some 5 years in capacities that gave you direct, I think, insights into what can be done by an effective Congress and what certainly needs to be done at this moment.
Tell us about. I appreciate that, Frank. And you're right. This is sort of a replay in many ways of the election of 1994 in that Republicans took control in early 95 and they did not waste time. They had contract with America, which Newt Gingrich had put together, which was a delivery. They had the opportunity to deliver a little more than we can right now, but delivery on some of those constructive promises. They also, however, went very aggressively in the direction of understanding what oversight was about. And so my portion of oversight related to justice, state, defense, and NASA. And we particularly focused initially on justice, which I think is what this Congress is going to have to do again. And we started to peel back layers of the onion. And you do that with document requests, and you do that with serious-minded interrogatories, if necessary, depositions. When I ran the Waco hearings in 95, we ended up having to do, I think, in the range of roughly 8 witnesses. And yeah. Talk to them behind the scenes, et cetera. The bottom line is you have to pick your priorities in oversight. And, you know, this is like walking into a smorgasbord because there's so much you could do oversight into. You have to be careful not to allow the other side to sucker punch you into doing something that's purely political. And I would say that the top maybe 5 priorities they have are getting at the integrity of this White House, meaning how compromised are they relative to China? I would say number 2 might be the border. We really have a real dereliction of duty there. And, you know, the goal cannot be impeachment, but there may be the side effect of impeachments. The goal has to be getting at truths so the American people see it, and so that you can make course corrections. We always said, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse was our target, and that's true, but misuse and abuse of power by political actors or failure to do their jobs is also part of that. I also think in that mix, you've got to go after the behavior of the Justice Department, the way in which that department has become politicized, both in the things that they do and in the things they don't do. When you don't enforce statutes that protect Supreme Court justices, when you do go after a sitting a former president who's a political opponent, those are things that really are unprecedented in our historical record. So that's a third issue. I think you have to look at national security broadly and what they're doing to the Defense Department. I think it's really devastating. We have a real readiness crisis right now in the Defense Department, by which I mean record low recruitment. We have a record low indicia of readiness, and at the same time, we're pushing wokeness as if getting trophies for being leftist is going to be what makes a good military. China doesn't give a hoot about that. What they care about is winning wars, and that's what we have to care about. And maybe finally, I would look—maybe it's my prejudice—but I look at the State Department and the way in which they have mishandled a number of things, from Afghanistan up through the way that they're currently managing some of the national dialogue. We are not in the business, and we should not be in the business of bailing out the world on everything from those that feel aggrieved by the fact that weather is affecting their lives and somehow blame us, to the idea that we're gonna cut off our own energy nose in order to fight our face. We're not going to do that. And what we need to do then is get after it. So energy, together with, I think, our international approach, foreign affairs would be the last issue. Got big things. That's the key.
Those are key points, no question about it, Bobby. Let me ask you, as a man who's reverential towards the Constitution, as I am and as I think we all need to be, especially those of us who swore an oath to protect and defend it. What I see happening with these international arrangements and agreements that have been fashioned just in the past week, the G20, where we committed to have the World Health Organization essentially running and dictating vaccine passports for anyone who wishes to engage in international travel. And then at Bali, then at the COP27, you had the decision taken to transfer initially small amounts, but the precedent being set for very large amounts of money in the form of reparations. None of this with any kind of mandate or authorization from the people's representatives in the Congress, and no accountability as far as I can tell, at least so far.
You're so right. And I think one of the things you're pointing out is something that used to be obvious to us from about fourth or fifth grade forward. And that is, a president of the United States is elected to serve the people of the United States, the same way the governor of Maine is elected to serve the people of Maine. And the bottom line here is, you have a president who's decided, well, or the cabal around him have decided, that our job is to bail out the rest of the world, apologize to the rest of the world, not lead by influencing in a favorable direction the way Ronald Reagan did, and frankly, a lot of Democrat and Republican have, not leading the world by example, but kowtowing, begging and borrowing, and letting them come at you with all their grievances. That is not what being a president of the United States is about. It is about serving citizens of the United States with everything you've got. And if that involves compromise internationally, so be it. But I look at this right now and I see it is a boat adrift. It has broken from the dock. It's drifting in a bad direction.
Heading toward the shoals. Said like a naval intelligence officer. We'll be right back with more with Robert Charles right after this. We're back. We're continuing our conversation with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles, and we're going to pivot from the various things that the Congress needs to be doing to something that is very ominous that the Justice Department has now announced is underway. And that is the appointment of a special counsel to pursue two possible prosecutorial lines of attack against Donald Trump, one involving his role in the January 6th insurrection, and the second, the mishandling of classified information in storage, allegedly improperly, at Mar-a-Lago. Bobby Charles, again, you've had a lot of experience in government. You have seen a lot of antics on the part of government agencies. How would you characterize this announcement by Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, on Friday afternoon, a time when skullduggery often takes place in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. You know, Frank, I have great respect for the law and historically have had great respect for attorneys general. And I always have assumed that the law, this is the wrong assumption, obviously, these days, but that the law would be used in a way fair and even-handed, and that's why we believe in our laws. This is the wrong move at the wrong time, the wrong message. And what it looks like to the world, I will tell you, is that we have become the very thing that we have railed against others becoming. We have become a country where a sitting president can take his opponent, both former and current, and can turn that opponent into, it can use the laws of the land in a political way, like a sword, to skewer his political opponent. It is what it looks like. And I say that because you have to look at this in the totality of circumstances. This looks like they are adding pebble after pebble after pebble to one end of a scale in order to finally get a tip that will prevent this president or this former president from making a credible run at the office. This is exactly what you see, and I won't name the countries, but this is what you see in parts of Africa, in South America, in parts of what was Eastern Europe and what is Eastern Europe, part of the Soviet Union. This is what we tell the world you don't do. You don't politicize your Justice Department or your bench in order to skewer a political opponent. So perception.
And you spent during your time as Assistant Secretary of State a lot of time and energy in countries around the world, essentially trying to encourage them to embrace the rule of law and, you know, steer clear of these kinds of tendencies. And here we are exhibiting them ourselves. It must be heartbreaking.
It's very disappointing. It just feels like it makes a mockery of what we say we believe, because we're not acting if we believe what we say we believe. You know, the thing I was just saying, you know, when you do this, rule of law is a phrase people use, they bandy it about, and is commonly misunderstood. But what it means is that you respect the law as an unbiased baseline, something that you will go back to regardless of politics to fairly administer, well, basically to administer fairness and reasonable justice. And when you see again and again and again this administration, I mean, I'm still in shock, frankly, that they violated, I think, the Fourth Amendment with a general warrant turned the president's home upside down. I cannot even really imagine it. If you read that in any history book up to now, you would have said, well, that must have been a horrifically politically corrupt environment. And so, you know, what part of, to take this topic and put it together with the last one, Frank, oversight involves getting at truth. And part of that is getting at the fair administration of laws. I think there's a fair argument to be made without, it's hard to do this without politics, but that the law, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and the Sixth Amendment have a precedent with the way that we use them. And also there's a precedent with the way we use special counsels. And we do not use them to do political damage. That's not what they're there for. And when you do that, that really qualifies as abuse of power.
There are those who, of course, argue, and Merrick Garland did, that this is just about removing from politics the possible prosecution of this president at a moment when he has announced he's running and his rival is perhaps going to be Joe Biden. That seems unlikely to me, but for the purpose of the discussion, that's the case. You find that incredible, I take
it. You know, listen, suppose Jimmy Carter had opened a special counsel investigation into Ronald Reagan's Hollywood career, or suppose that, you know, Richard Nixon had, you know, opened something up on Lyndon Johnson or Hubert Humphrey. I mean, it smacks of political gotchaism. And the problem is, Frank, that we as Americans have to trust our government. This is all we've got, right?
You're right. It's the only government we got, for sure. Let me ask you specifically about the individual who has been named to be the special counsel. Does that further intensify the concerns you're expressing about the politicization
bio,
of this?
I don't know him. It isn't so much the personalities, Frank. You know, you could have appointed, you know, a former Republican attorney general. It wouldn't matter. What you're doing here, honestly, what you're doing is you're making a very clear political statement at the same time that you say you're making a purely legal statement. And the political statement is that this president is suspect of violating laws worthy of prosecution. The January 6th thing has been, I think this is now the 7th investigation or the 8th investigation. To my view, it's something that we have kicked to death to the point where we're just standing in a pile of dust. And if you have an opinion on it, you probably got an opinion on it. And at the end of the day, it does not look to me like you can find a criminal act on behalf of the president. And most lawyers would probably say that. The second thing they're looking at, this business about, you know, how he, well, I would say that there's another piece to this investigation, which is that they've opened the wide scope. They've said that they can go after anything that he's done in terms of the collection of documents and the holding of documents. Again, if you look at the predicate, and we have not seen the affidavit's warrant, so we don't know if it's a general warrant or it's a specific warrant. And if it's a specific warrant, you have to identify what you're getting, where you're getting it from, and for what purpose. And it looks administrative. So why are we appointing for what is largely administrative handling? And one last point on that, Frank.
And we're out of time, Bobby. I'm afraid we have to let you go. Thank you. One last point we'll come back to with you the next time, as we will about Jack Smith, the special counsel designee. Thank you for all joining us, folks. I hope you come back to us for more in the next edition of Securing America. In the meantime, go forth and multiply.